yeah, like the U.S. economy is not doing great outside of data centers and a few other sort of really specific parts, but you're actually seeing U.S. oil demand growth year over year and sort of seasonally all-time high, it looks like, actually, oil demand in the U.S. And then globally, you're at all-time high levels of demand for oil. So it's sort of funny, like what you would think is happening in the oil market is actually quite different from what's actually happening right now in the oil market.
Josh Young, Bison Interests, and you have a new Substack now, Bison Insights. How's it going, man?
Going great. How are you?
That's going really good. We're going to talk about one of my favorite subjects, which is energy. And I was telling you off camera, I really cut my teeth in energy. I'm originally from Alaska, which is a high oil and gas. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I was mostly interested in that oil up in Alaska with Prudhoe Bay. So if you were to ask me a year ago or 2 years ago that oil prices would be where they're at right now, I would say you're completely out of your mind. Why are we seeing this? Really, I wouldn't call it a collapse, but it certainly is, I guess, a fall in the oil prices. Yeah, tell me about that. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's stunning. I think the only thing that is a little more surprising and crazier than oil being at, what is it, 57 WTI as we're talking right now,
yep,
is that the folks that were bearish on it correctly over the last couple of years still think that it's going to collapse from here. And when you look at it on an inflation adjusted basis, you look back to, let's say, 2007, 2008, and you know your rent or your home is two or three times higher than that. And you go to the grocery store and your grocery bill, it looks nothing like what it did 20 years ago, 15 years ago. But you know, I just bought gas today for my car, and I mean, it's $2.40 a gallon here in Houston. And yeah, so it's really inflation adjusted. It's materially lagged. I think the price is sort of shockingly low. And I'd say overall, we've done pretty well in terms of figuring out what's going to happen in oil and gas markets since we launched Bison Interests about a decade ago. But this move down since roughly, you know, really the big sort of re-rating down from 2023 or so has been sort of shocking. And when you see that, right, and you experience that and you miss it, you spend a lot of time figuring out, hey, what did I do wrong? What am I missing? And what's going to happen next? And so I guess, one, we got it wrong. Two, let's figure out what might actually happen next.
Yeah, well, talk to me about that. What do you think is going to happen next? Because I guess I see two things. Well, I see three things that are happening and obviously will have an effect. The first one is I see oil supply. And again, I want your opinion on this. It seems to me like it's not itself dropping off a cliff, but it's certainly level, if you would. And then you have, it seems like a slowdown in the economy. So that's obviously, it seems like it'd be very bearish with oil. But then you have all this geopolitical tension here, whether that's in the Middle East, whether that's with Russia, and now it looks like with Venezuela. So again, you have several things pulling or pushing up or down oil. But yeah, what's your opinion? What's going to happen next over the next 3, 6, 12 months?
So a lot of it goes into what I got wrong. So one, there's actually burgeoning oil supplies right now. If you look at supplies today versus supplies a year ago, not in the US, US production, especially onshore, has mostly flattened out. And it looks like we're close to seeing that actually decline. And that's a big deal because that's where most of the global oil production growth has come from over the last decade, especially if you include natural gas liquids. But you are seeing extra production from Guyana. You're seeing extra production from offshore Brazil. These were, especially on the Brazil side, it was always supposed to come and never came, and it finally actually showed up. You're seeing more production from Kazakhstan, where you saw a major multi-tens of billions of dollar oil project offshore that Chevron was involved in finally come on. And then you're also seeing roughly a million barrels a day more from Iran and more oil from Libya and various other places globally feeding into the geopolitical observation. We're at a weird. It's you wouldn't know it from the news headlines, but we're at a weird geopolitical lull in terms of supply disruptions, where supplies have gone from 1 million barrels a day off to, let's say, 6 million barrels a day off, depending on different circumstances. Right now, over the last, let's say, 20 years, and right now we're in this sort of 1 million barrels a day off. So we're way on the oversupply versus sort of norm from geopolitical risk and geopolitical disruption. So that's where sort of the big things are. And then in terms of recession, like the US economy is not doing great outside of data centers and a few other sort of really specific parts, but you're actually seeing US oil demand growth year over year and sort of seasonally all-time high, it looks like actually oil demand in the US. And then globally, you're at all-time high levels of demand for oil. So it's sort of funny, like the what you would think is happening in the oil market is actually quite different from what's actually happening right now in the oil market.
So that really, what you just said, really builds a huge bullish. And again, I have invested interest in this, but it builds a huge bullish case for oil, where oil could really climb really, really quickly. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, so it could, but there's also the problem of what's happened to get us here. So we currently have all of this production online from places like Iran, where you have Trump having promised to cut off the production and do maximum pressure. And it turned out that the election promise of drill, baby, drill was true for Venezuela and Iran and these other countries, and not for the U.S. So you have this production on. So until it comes off, that's actually going to continue to pressure the oil market. So it is a setup for potentially much higher prices soon if you get production off in Libya, where there's been sort of flare-ups, brief flare-ups of the civil war. If you get there's just a second tanker that was supplying the Houthis in Yemen that had a mysterious fire that was allegedly an accident, but it's the second one. So maybe it's that they use really old tankers, or maybe it's that someone has decided they don't want the Houthis to get oil. If the Houthis don't get oil and LPG, then maybe other countries don't get and other groups don't get oil as well. So there's risk there. There's tensions rising again with Iran, between Israel and Iran, where more analysts on the geopolitical side are seeing it more likely that there's going to be another sort of set of strikes, and maybe that'll impact oil supplies too. And then Russia, where it's been one of the stranger things I think I've seen in my career, watching Ukraine destroy or severely damage refinery after refinery in Russia. And there are local gas lines in Russia, so they're having trouble adequately supplying their people with gasoline. But you see actually oil exports from Russia last month at near multi-year highs. And you saw product exports that were actually pretty robust, sort of surprisingly robust. Maybe it's coming out of inventories that weren't well understood. Maybe it was sort of already in the process and is going to get delayed. But it's one of those just very odd things. Yeah, they had extra supply. Yeah, they had extra refining capacity. But at some point, if you bomb enough of these big things, if Ukraine does that and they bomb some of the export terminals too, and if you just count the number of barrels that have been destroyed purely from ignoring any disruption, just purely destroyed from their different drone attacks and so on, you would think that that would have a pretty significant impact. And yet, for now, in the measured data, it hasn't yet.
Okay, and so let's talk about the data here. How much do you trust the data? Because it has me scratching my head at times, but talk about that. Yeah.
So there, some people have tinfoil hats, and I have a
That's
lovely
yours.
250 WTI hat that my buddy made. We're actually going to launch a merch store for our newsletter, which is just mostly silly. I don't know, we'll make any money on it, but I have the 250 WTI hat, and I still think we're going to get there and maybe further this cycle, because when you see the suppression efforts at oil price, suppression that we're seeing by the Trump administration and by various others, maybe to pressure Russia into peace with Ukraine, maybe because of some sort of weird goal for the 2% wallet share that gasoline takes of US consumers, to deflect from like the 30% wallet share that real estate takes, and where there's been massive inflation, or groceries or various other stuff. But whatever the sort of primary driver of that is when you see price suppression of the sort that we're seeing, almost always historically, you've seen backlash and you've seen sort of the unintended consequences of that lead to shortages and then radically high prices. We even saw it in the US where we tried to suppress prices of oil and gold and various products in the late 60s, early 70s, and that backfired gloriously. The Nixon administration sort of implemented almost a Biden-esque style economic policy, which Trump has embraced to some extent on the energy side. And, these things fail. And so, do they fail in 6 months or fail in 5 years? I don't know. And that makes it sort of harder to say what will happen tomorrow. But you sort of know what's going to happen almost definitely. There's nothing is certain, but almost every price suppression attempt in history of a commodity has led to prices go much higher. And again, the most relevant one for oil, I think, is the Nixon attempt, late 60s, early 70s, which, I mean, led to all kinds of problems on commodities, not just oil.
Right. Okay. So two questions here. What is role does OPEC play in all this? Because it seems like they would want much higher prices if you would. And I want to make this clear too. I do have skin in the game, if you would. That being said, it's not like I'm trying to argue. I'm not pro OPEC, if that makes sense. I'm agnostic, but that is a big influencer in our space, if you would. So talk about that. And then it seems like at oil, less than $60 a barrel, are any companies, especially the smaller ones, making any money? It seems like they'd be turning off the spouts.
Yeah, these are great questions. So first of all, so I did actually get to go meet with the OPEC guys
Did
in
you really?
Vienna, yeah, in February. I
That's
got
so
to,
cool.
well, it was even better than I expected. So I went to this thing. They don't like their publicity, and so there are some news articles about OPEC and about the people involved that are very, very negative, sort of almost inappropriately negative. And so I don't like it when people say untrue, mean things about me publicly. So, I can sympathize with that. So, they had a number of folks who were less publicly critical of them come meet with them and sort of learn about how they see the world and their media approach and their data analysis approach and so on. And again, this was fascinating to me because at Bison Interests, we published multiple white papers about how OPEC's spare capacity was overstated. And so when I got the invite, I was pretty sure they like messed up and they wanted to invite someone else and not me. And they were sort of confused, but no, they meant for me to be there. So I go and meet with them. And they had this whole day prepared, all these different presentations and conversations. You get to see, they took us on a tour. You got to see the oil library and their basement and got to see all kinds of interesting stuff. At the very end, they did sort of an impromptu, like happy hour type thing, except, they're mostly Muslim, so they don't drink. So a non-alcoholic happy hour. And then after that, they looked exhausted, but they like still wanted to hang out. So almost everyone left. They had like planned dinners and various other things. The Goldmans and JP Morgans of the world all have, very big important things to do. And so it was me and one analyst from, I think, Argus and one other sort of independent person sitting down in the lobby of the Hilton Hotel in Vienna with the Secretary General of OPEC, who's sitting like right next to me, and then their head of macro slash head of research. And I'm terrible with names, so I'm not gonna try to butcher them. Just and they have formal names that I'll respect. And then a few other OPEC folks were there hanging out and got to sit with them for almost 2 hours. At the end of this whole thing, so they're completely exhausted. Yeah. And one of the amazing things about this is, look, like in a 30-minute conversation that's planned, that's whatever, you can say whatever you want and be somewhat believable. At the end of the day, when you're like b just back from some trips, when you're about to go to some more trips, when you're, just exhausted, like you could see the exhaustion. People's eyes start to glaze over. It's really hard to misrepresent what you think or what's going on. It's just not like, it's just human nature. It's one of those great things about attending conferences, about meeting people. Like, you get these opportunities to get sort of real, genuine interpretations and real. So, I don't think they're that worried about the immediate term price of oil. I think They're most worried about preserving sort of the long tail and sort of the area under the curve. And again, like, did they say this exactly? No, this is my interpretation of what they were saying. I think they're very worried about sort of this ESG DEI type push against oil investment and against oil demand, not because they're so worried that it's actually going to destroy oil demand, but they're worried that it's going to cause a super spike in the price of oil and that would lead to oil demand destruction. And so that's my interpretation. Again, like they've said different things, but that's what I heard. And so their view isn't, hey, is there going to be a 1 million barrel a day build in Q4 or two or half? They have a view on it and they pay people a lot of money to try to figure out and they care, but they don't, that's not what they're trying to solve for. They're trying to solve for not having oil do what natural gas did in 2021 and 22, where it went up 10x. And
Parabolic.
European natural gas demand is way down from where, even as prices came down, it's way down from where it was in 2021, even though the world has reopened from COVID and all this stuff. So they're trying to avoid that, as far as I can tell. And so that makes what they're doing right now extremely interesting. And again, like what the OPEC organization wants isn't always what their member countries like Saudi Arabia or Russia or whatever want, but they're sort of all like, they're all paddling in the same direction in a big boat, and then sometimes someone like pulls a little too far in one direction or whatever, but they're sort of like they're in the
They're in this
organization for a
together.
reason. Yeah, they're aligned, they're funding this. It's not cheap, it's not simple for them to do all this stuff. They get called all kinds of names for it. It's very, very misunderstood in terms of like what they're actually trying to do, from what I can tell. I'm not paid by them. They did reimburse my like trip costs or something, but man, like 3 days flying back and forth the economy to Vienna, man, like that's not, like I should have billed them. But so just to be clear, in terms of financial conflicts, I don't see any. Again, like I see sort of a negative on my part, but still very, very interesting. I'm glad to have met them. So why does that matter? So I don't think they want there to be an oil surplus, but I think they're way more worried about there being an oil shortage. And so with OPEC raising their quotas right now, they are risking an oil shortage, right? Because if you bring on all your spare capacity, what happens when demand grows by 1 million barrels a day? Where does it come from? So what I think they're doing, and they definitely did not tell me this, but this is just knowing them, studying their numbers very carefully, being one of the first to come out and question OPEC's spare capacity in decades, basically since of Twilight in the Desert back there, since Matt Simmons pushed on this a while ago. People have basically not talked about this for a decade. We came out in 2021 and pushed on it, and within a month, the number two guy from Saudi Aramco was talking about how we needed more investment for spare capacity. We saw the OPEC guys start to talk about it very shortly after we put out stuff. Russia was talking about it again, like within 2 months or so of Bison putting out our work on OPEC plus spare capacity. So I think they know it's an issue, and we talked about it a little bit. And so what I think they're going to do, best I can tell, is they're going to put as much oil on the market as the market can absorb. And as they're aware of Brazil raising production, they're aware of Guyana, they're aware of the status with shale. They've done a lot of work, as far as I can tell, on shale and trying to understand exactly what it is and what it isn't and what's actually going to happen, and being able to look through the sort of nonsensical EIA sort of modeled numbers and political stuff at the IEA. Very important in understanding the oil market. And so what I think they're going to do is just try to raise their production as much as they can. Which solves an internal problem for them, and it also solves the oil market problem for them. So the internal problem is that you have countries that claim they have spare capacity that don't. And so the best way to tell who has spare capacity is to turn it on. And it's sort of like the political thing, right? The way you can tell what country is best run is you open the borders and see which direction, it's like communism failed. How do you know? Because when the wall came down in Germany, everyone from East Germany ran to West Germany, not the other way around. That's like why New York's making this big mistake, and why, it's very simple. So similar idea, right? Like if you raise your quotas to the point where people are allowed to produce as much as they want for the first time in a very long time in OPEC's history, you get to see who actually has it. And they think, from what I can tell, what I think, which is that there's millions of barrels a day of overstated spare capacity. So one, that's hugely beneficial to the oil market in terms of pricing oil,
Because you
is
get real
as you,
data.
yeah, But as
Yeah.
you prove that it's not 7 or 8 million barrels a day of spare capacity at the start of this year, it was really three. And as you bring on two and you have one left, it's a very different oil market. And so you get a lot more money per barrel that you produce while producing the same amount once people, I think, understand what the real sort of spare capacity situation is. The other benefit is, so that's the big oil market solution for them.
Well
The
said.
small one is that they have all these like fights over who gets what quota and so on. All the countries, they elevate their spare capacity numbers to be able to argue that they can get more quota when there are cutbacks due to a weak economy or various other things. And so they solve an internal problem from what I can tell, and they solve this external problem. And my expectation is that to the extent that there is a glut, to the extent that we see enormous inventory buildups, which people are claiming, and maybe we're starting to see that. We'll see, right? There's lots of data quality issues and lots of questions. Inventories are falling right now in China, falling globally onshore, rising on the water by a lot. And so we'll see where it goes and what happens and how much of that is offshore, China, Iranian barrels that will not get bought, how much of that is real that's going to get bought and used commercially and so on, how much is going into some sort of SPR. We'll see. There's a real sort of question mark there. What gives me comfort here, and what I think the equity market's actually starting to look through and expect, is that I think at the end of this, you either have full absorption of these OPEC barrels with maybe a million or two left of real spare capacity. Maybe it's four of claimed spare capacity and one or two of real at the end of this after OPEC's brought back this production. And you have oil get back to 80 or 90 or something dollars a barrel in a balanced market, with another 2 million barrels a day on the market from OPEC. So that's like a win for them. If that doesn't happen, if you end up with these big inventory builds, the IEA has like a 4 or 5 million barrel a day build number now for, I think it's Q1 next year, which is nonsensical. But in a circumstance where you get anywhere close to that, my expectation is OPEC will get as close to the line as possible without fully glutting the market, without, overfilling storage or anything. And then they'll cut 2 million barrels a day, but at least they'll know who gets to cut and who has to cut based on their ability to have actually delivered based on these quota increases that we've seen over the last 18 months or so. So I think that's what's happening. It's the best I can tell based on some combination of knowing the people, chatting with them about it, reading their stuff carefully, meeting the various folks. Part of the benefit of going there was seeing who's actually sort of like their mouthpiece or their whatever, or who's sort of the opposite of that. So it was very helpful, I think, in terms of like sorting which oil analysts to pay attention to for different things, in addition to better understanding the OPEC guys themselves. So that's my best I can tell. And again, I'm open to being wrong on this. There's no guarantees in this, but I think this is what's going on. And I think it's very promising because if what I describe plays out in one of a number of the different ways I shared, I think you end up with a path towards 80, which is way higher than the forward curve of like 51 or something. And then you have a path for it to get back to that, what I think they think is was a very good price level, which is that sort of $100 plus level, inflation adjusted back to the, let's say, 2011 type timeframe. I think that's sort of where, if you looked at it from a 30,000 foot view and said, hey, where should oil be given what you know about the world right now, where various other commodities are, where various world economies are, where demand is, that's probably where you'd think it should be. And there's many other ways to come to that. But I think they see that too. I think they're going to try to get to that, but they're not exactly solving for that. I think they're trying to solve for credibility issues, quota issues, internal group dynamic issues, and to start actually getting credit for the little bit of spare capacity that countries that have prudently invested, like UAE, like Kuwait now, Saudi Arabia has done this a little bit. They actually want economic credit for this spare capacity. And it seems like this is their solution to get to a world where they get credit for that, while also getting a combination again of like cohesion and sort of adherence to quotas, and also not having experienced a super spike, which again, I'm not sure they'll be able to accomplish that last part. I think we end up with way higher prices due to some other factors, but I get it. It makes sense to me. It's not it's there's moments where it's scary one direction or another, but I get it. And I think it's one reason to be quite optimistic about oil. Maybe not for tomorrow, because I don't know what tomorrow brings, but as I look forward, let's say 6 months, 12 months, I see prices much higher than the consensus.
Okay, so to all my viewers and listeners, Josh, that was probably the best answer and analysis I have heard a person give. So I'm thankful to that, and I mean that, not to stroke your ego, not that you have an ego, but not to stroke your ego, but that was well done, and well done for flying out there. Wow. I mean, what a fascinating story. What a fascinating trip. And it does really give you a lot of insight that you can make a view, if you would, a view of the world and oil over the next several months, if not years. So that's a treat to all of my viewers and listeners. There's two other things I want to get to, but I want to talk about just oil companies suffering here at below $60 a barrel, your analysis of that. And then I want to talk about Matt Simmons. I read his book. I want to say it was 2010-ish, 2011, if I'm not mistaken. He passed away, I believe, around that time, but it was right before he passed away. But I'd like to talk about that. And then what other factors you see that could possibly make a super spike in oil. But talk to me. There's a lot of destruction in smaller oil companies with sub 60 oil. Is that correct?
Well, I actually think there's more destruction at large oil companies at this point. So where we're at now, and part of why I'm so interested in these small caps is the companies that have survived on the smaller side are extremely lean, they're extremely efficient. They're not all, let's say, well run in the sense that, their governance stuff is nonsense and their executives get paid too much relative to the size of the companies. But generally, overall, compared to where you would have been at for small oil companies at any point in the last 20 years, they're probably the best run, they're probably the most efficient, they're probably the lowest cost that you would expect, with a few exceptions. I think the very new ones that have been private equity backed in the last couple of years or so, the very sort of aggressive ones, th those maybe are an exception, but sort of broadly, the smaller public companies and so on, I think, and some of the privates that have been around for a while, those are very well positioned and actually weirdly at sort of a lower cost structure than some of the other than some of the other companies. The larger companies are stuck sort of in this weird bureaucratic morass. They got it really into this ESG thing, really into DEI. They have all kinds of like engineering fallacy projects that are going on, whether it's direct air capture of carbon. I mean, what are you even trying to do there? Or like here we're gonna like go into the Gulf of Mexico and pump tons of carbon dioxide into empty pore space, or I don't know. I mean, there's all
It's
kinds
like
of
a head scratching. What are you doing?
weird nonsense. Yeah, and then you have these companies. So I get to see all these really interesting reports, and I have friends in various places. And actually, I've gotten really interested in oil field services, which has been really beneficial, weirdly, in understanding bigger oil companies because they're the biggest buyers of these oil field services. And you get to see their benchmarking, and you get to see sort of how the oil field services companies describe drilling wells and what they measure themselves on versus what, the Exxons and Shells and Chevrons and BPs and, Oxys and whatever of the world's describe themselves. And these guys are very high cost, very inefficient operators. In some cases, they only benchmark their wells versus themselves, which is just
That's insane.
absolutely wild. Like they say, as like a self-help thing, you should just consider yourself and make progress. But as an organization, you should definitely look around at other companies that are the same or similar as you and compare yourself to them. And if you are drilling bottom decile wells and then you get to bottom quartile instead of bottom decile, you do not deserve a prize. You probably need to get fired and you need someone else to come in. And so there's an enormous amount of waste, and it appears corruption and mismanagement and bureaucracy. And then also all of this sort of like government nonsense, a lot of that's still in the NGOs here in the US and even more abroad. And a lot of that's also in the big companies. There's still this just like weird, like woke sickness. And you see it in these organizational structures. And when you interact with them and see what's going on, I mean, they're apparently at many of these large companies, they have teams of people to drill wells, to complete wells, to optimize wells, and so on, that don't have assigned rigs or pressure pumping equipment or other workover equipment. They just do theoretical tasks and they have
That's all they
whole
do.
things. Yeah. They have whole things. Like, honestly, like I talked to the services guys and they have nothing bad to say about any of their customers, of course. But the thing that frustrates them most is dealing with these phantom teams at these different large oil and gas companies. And so on one hand, it's terrible that there's these layoffs and so on at these different companies. And the way they do it is horrible too. They should fire the people who are bad performing. And instead they just fire like 20% arbitrary. And then they have to hire back the great people because there are really, truly brilliant and fantastic people at Exxon, at Chevron, at Conoco, at Shell.
Sure.
There's great people at these companies. And those are the people typically they're working so hard, they don't do a good job with politics, so they get laid off. And then they get hired back at like 2x the comp for a while in many cases, as consultants or whatever, because it turns out that those jobs were actually needed. So I actually see it very different. I look at the financials, right? And there's some stories that are told in financials that I think are partial truths at best. And the thing I would look for in these companies is how much of a cost structure is driven by legacy versus how much of a cost structure is driven by activity. And then what's the trajectory? And so, you know, when I look at these big oil companies going and paying huge prices for large shale companies, huge prices for cash flow and inventory and whatever. And then see what they do with it, and then see that they're even doing it, right? With these claims, oh, we have 20 years of inventory, and oh, yeah, we're also paying $40 billion for this oil company or 20 or whatever. And it tells you one that they're lying, or that they don't understand, or that they have no value for the money that they're spending on these assets that they're buying. And so there are real problems. And so part of my interest in investing in smaller oil and gas companies is they're a lot cheaper on valuation, but also we're weirdly in this world where they're a lot better, and they're a lot better at sort of extracting oil at reasonable prices. And so I think where you're going to see activity cuts, it's going to be in the Exxons and Chevrons. And again, not about any particular one, but those are the companies where there is all this bloat and where they could cut two or three rigs and potentially get the same production because they're drilling stuff that they shouldn't be drilling, and they're doing a bad job with it, and they're spending too much on it. And so, even now in 2025, 11 years after oil prices crashed, and OPEC declared a price war essentially on shale in 2014. And so, here you are still with these companies not having figured this stuff out. And so, that's where I would point to where the real suffering, I don't think, is in these smaller companies that have been able to knock their costs down and are able to really dynamically navigate around oil and gas price concerns. I think it's in these big companies that they're just stuck. And they don't even know what to do, and they can't fire their worst people because of ESG or DEI or whatever issues, or they don't want to. And a lot of the managers maybe are there because of DEI and so on. So there's just this real mess. And it sounds weird, I know, to say that's going on in oil and gas, but I actually think oil and gas companies maybe are the worst of the bunch, or among the worst of the bunch, because they tried to virtue signal and tried to do all this other nonsense to try to, you know, fit in at the country clubs or whatever. So anyway, that's probably not what you were expecting to hear, but that's the more I learn
No,
about
I'm
this, the more I
glad.
interact with these guys, the more I think this.
Yeah, no, it's great. That's a great answer too. No, I wasn't expecting that, but again, well said. And I don't know if we're going to be able to get to natural gas or not because I have two other questions, and I want to respect your time. But what other triggers do you see that would send oil prices much higher? You mentioned that there are a couple of other factors or a few other factors. What are some of those for us?
Okay, so US production is going into decline here on a crude oil basis.
Right.
And we're just not running enough rigs right now. And you don't see it as much in the public company results, especially the larger ones, because they've been going and buying production and they're sort of hiding it. And so this is wonderful as an owner of small producers or
You get
small
bought
oil
out.
assets, because these guys are coming in and paying pretty high prices for stuff that don't make a lot of sense unless you think about it from this context. So you're not seeing it in all of the company's headlines, but you are seeing it at the field level and the well level. You can count the number of rigs running, you can track their efficiency, you can count the number of pressure pumping stacks, spreads running, and match their efficiency. Some of the services guys I've gotten to know are among the most bullish I mean, there's not many people that are bullish oil here anymore, but the services guys are, which is again fascinating because some of these guys, they're literally counting the barrels as they're coming out of the wells of the fields that you have all these people on TV talking about how there's infinite production, oh, it's going to grow, EIA's, oh, it's going to grow. It's like, well, let's talk to the people that are actually doing it. And then not happening. So that's a problem because once you get this wave of production right now from Brazil, Brazil's probably topping out. Kazakhstan has mostly topped out and probably is going into decline soon. They're not doing another cash can. It's just not happening. And you know, Guyana is growing, but at a measured level. And for every Guyana, there's five Mexicos where Cantarell is still in decline, and you have all these other issues. And even places that left OPEC, so like Angola, leaves OPEC in order to be able to grow. You look at their production, and it's like, well, what were you even doing? Why were you like leaking this stuff to these reporters about how terrible it is? You know, here you've left, and maybe your production's up like 2% or something, but they're really struggling. And then you have all these other issues with these other countries that again are similar to Cantarell, where you have these old fields. People think, oh, okay, mature oil fields mean that decline rates are very low. And it's a true until it's not. When depending on the dynamic of reservoirs or so on, like you can have fields like, I think this is how Cantarell works, where you had oil up here and you have water sort of below, and the water is high pressure, and as you pump the oil out, the water sort of pushes the oil up towards your wellbore, let's say at the top. And so once the water gets above where the well's contacting the reservoir, you end up just with water and almost no oil. And so there's a number of different reservoirs like that, and there's other similar sorts of production issues in different kinds of drive fields, but that are sort of net effectively similar to that very intuitive and simple way that you could go from producing, let's say, 1 million barrels a day from a field to producing 10,000 barrels a day from a field, which again is what you're
Oh
seeing.
gosh.
Yeah, I mean, Cantarell has collapsed, and so they've drilled more
Gosh.
wells into it, and it's just collapsed.
There's no oil
So,
there. Yeah.
yeah, I mean, there is still some oil there, but
There's
it's in
10,000 as
pockets and it's
opposed to a
hard.
million, right?
And like the actual numbers, I think it's like 200,000 instead of 2 million or 3 million, whatever it is, it's
Think
just
about that.
catastrophic. And that's even with workovers and new wells and whatever. And so we're seeing these issues across a number of different fields, and we're seeing the estimates of, even by the very sort of bearish energy consultants and so on, of global decline rates. We're seeing those estimates rise. First of all, people are even talking about this, which they used to not talk about, but they're rising from 3% to 6%. The right number might be 10 or 12. And so that's just an enormous amount of oil needs to come on every year. And sort of the best part from a bullish perspective and the worst part from wanting sort of energy supply and stability and not to get a super spike is that the new production, part of how the decline rate got so high is that new production is much higher decline than most other production. So you come on with a shale well and you might be at an 80% decline rate in the first year from the initial production rate. You come on with a conventional well and you're still probably at a 20 or 30% decline rate. That's the thing people don't understand about Guyana, for example. People say, oh, these big wells, 20,000 barrels a day, 10,000 barrels a day, like this is great. But it doesn't really help you so much if you come on with that and then you start to decline. So you have to come back in and drill more of these wells. And some of them are choked and some of them just sort of start to naturally decline. And it's not that there's not a lot of oil in Guyana, it's that you end up with, this was Brazil's problem. You have to come back to where you have these FPSOs, floating production units, and drill more wells in order to be able to get your production back up. And that takes drill ships, that takes money, it takes time. And you can end up with Brazil, where you had forecasts for production growth every year for a decade. And finally, in 2025, they hit after, you know, literally like they were like 0 for 9. And so that's one of the things I missed. I was willing to bet on the 0 for 10, and I was wrong. And that's okay because next year they're going to miss, and the year after they're going to miss. And, you know, the odds, I think, are in my favor on that. So those are the big things. And then there's also just the very simple, I don't want to, I'm not an advocate of war or anything like that. I don't think you need it in order to have much higher oil prices. But the odds that you stay at this very low level of disruption of oil production from places that historically have had significant disruption, just seem low to me. You can have Trump claiming he's the peace president or whatever, but you know, when you look closely at these things, it's like, oh, I made peace between, you know, Israel and Hamas, and like a week later you have bombs going off in Gaza and, you know, potentially reportedly a Houthi supply boat with LPG blow up or catch on fire, or you know, maybe it was an accident. So when you look closely at these things, a lot of them are a lot less stable than they look based on the current oil supply levels. And again, if you just think about it as, hey, baseline, maybe it should be 2 million barrels a day offline, and right now you're at 1 million barrels a day offline, and you have Ukraine every night bombing Russian oil refineries, and you have Houthi supply boats catching on fire, and Israel and Iran maybe, you know, heating back up. I think that's sort of another trigger where we shouldn't be surprised for a meaningful temporary oil price spike from that. And then, if there's any sort of material sustained disruption, especially from Russia, but maybe from Iran or one of these other countries, I think that's where you could sort of, even before some of these other factors kick in, you could see oil prices much higher.
Got it. So, talk a little bit about Matt Simmons and his book that he wrote. And again, if my memory, it was in the early 2010-ish time. I don't remember the exact date. I remember reading that book, and I was completely mesmerized as I was reading, and I thought this was it. I don't want to say he was wrong. I was probably got the timing wrong, and I don't know exactly if. I don't re I'm not he was advocating more just more data, better data. I would say if there's anything he was advocating with the potential of oil spikes, so I wouldn't even say he was wrong. But they had this whole crowd of peak oil, and I was one of them, or very sympathetic to that, if you would. But where did that go wrong? Was it the Canadian shale coming online? Or yeah, tell me about that. It just was a lot more discovered. And then where are we at in relationship? Is that even a thing now, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at.
Matt was actually right about the Saudi oil fields. So people don't really talk about this too much, but you know, he highlighted issues with GWR, the largest, and I'm probably mispronouncing it, but something like that. And I think at the time it was producing 3 or 4 million barrels a day, and I think it's down closer to 1 million barrels a day
I'm
right now.
glad you pointed that out. Go ahead. Go ahead.
So he was not wrong about that. What he was wrong about was, one, technology got better. And so the Saudis have been drilling much more expensive oil wells in much less prolific fields since then. And they've brought on a lot of their sort of spare capacity type fields, which is one reason, like, I can do the math, but there's also just a reality, which is when you look at where Saudi Arabia is producing from, and you look at, let's say, 20 years ago, what the story was of where they would get their oil from next. They're producing from these fields that were supposed to be the spare capacity fields. So it's like, okay, well, what are you gonna, what's the next one? And there's not a really good answer for that. And they're using very expensive, very sophisticated equipment. And some of the best drillers in the world are there drilling more oil. And people have this idea that it's like the Beverly Hillbillies, you know, you shoot the ground and oil spouts out. And that is not the case at all anymore. They're way on the other end of the spectrum in terms of sophistication and in terms of energy and capital intensity to produce oil in Saudi Arabia. So Matt was right about everything except that technology plus a willingness to rapidly accelerate the development and ultimate depletion of secondary fields allowed Saudi Arabia to sustain and actually grow their oil production. So that was important specifically to Saudi. So he was not wrong about the specific issues, as far as I can tell, that he identified. And then there were some secondary and tertiary recovery projects that they implemented that are the reason that production's, let's say, 1 million barrels a day from GWR and not, you know, 100,000 barrels a day. So their secondary recovery is working. They are pumping chemicals in and huge amounts of water in, and they are actually fracking shale gas wells now. I always get the name wrong. It starts with an F, but they have a gas field that they're fracking, and it's very unproductive by U.S. standards, and it's very expensive. But it's still cheaper than it's cheaper to burn that gas than it is to burn oil for power, like they do most summers. So that's where some of that incremental or sustained supply from Saudi Arabia is coming from relative to Matt's analysis. The thing he missed in terms of, and I missed at the time, and it sounds like you might have missed, was the George Mitchell U.S. shale boom first for shale gas here that
Mm-hmm.
translated over via Harold Hamm and a few other folks' efforts on the oil side. I guess was it Mark Papa at EOG, him and Harold Hamm really sort of pushed it forward on the oil side, where they were able to apply these shale gas development techniques to shale oil and produce enormous amounts of oil from rock that basically everyone knew there was oil there, but everyone thought it was totally uneconomic to produce out. And that story is very, very well known at this point. But one, I think that's sort of a big thing to have gotten wrong, a huge thing. And then it's also important, I think, to understand what actually happened there, which was you took a ultra high cost reservoir or set of reservoirs, and through technology, you dropped the cost on producing it. And why that's relevant is, okay, well, what's the next reservoir that you're going to tap
Right.
that's much lower cost? Where is it? And is it a place where you're able to build pipes and able to get supply sustainably? And I think the answer for me is that, yeah, sure, there is more oil, right? You could produce more oil from the Canadian oil sands. The problem is that you have sort of this radical leftist corporatist government there that's sort of blocking Canadian oil for various reasons. Yeah, you can produce more oil in the Vaca Muerta in Argentina. That's been tested and it works, but it's more expensive, less productive, and unfortunately, the capitalist experiment in Argentina is relatively new, and there was a negative election result recently that seems to be unfortunately risking it. The US is now backstopping Argentina, which may actually backfire because I can't imagine that anyone wants the US to be backstopping them. Just given the history and so on, especially in South America. And so, there's lots of risk and uncertainty. And there are a few other fields like shale, like US shale in other places around the world. But really, for the most part, we're at the tail end. There's the Montney and Duvernay in Canada, which are great, but limited. And also, they're not fully developed, but there's a lot that's already been developed there. It's not like they're brand new. Where are you going to get the next Delaware Basin with 2 million barrels a day plus coming on? And I think this is even like what Trump has gotten wrong in his energy policy, where he's going around the world trying to beg various countries, including our enemies, to produce more oil to try to temporarily suppress the price. I think he thinks that you're going to see an energy sort of miracle or revolution or whatever, like we saw in his first administration, where prices were down, but production was up because of the Delaware Basin. You literally, I think you got something like 2 million barrels a day of incremental crude oil production in Trump's first presidential administration, almost exclusively from this one area of West Texas and Southeast New Mexico. And so the problem is that is probably in decline at this point, at least at current oil prices. So is the Bakken in North Dakota, and so is the Eagle Ford in South Texas, and so is, for the most part, the DJ in what is it, northern Colorado. So where are you going to get your next 2 million barrels a day in the US? And the answer is you probably don't, especially at $57 oil. You might at $120 oil, but not at 57. And so all you're doing is destroying the US services capacity, reducing the labor force, reducing the ability to actually ramp production when necessary. And I think sort of making a similar mistake to some of the prior sort of energy policy mistakes that we've seen that have led to much higher oil prices. Again, it's sort of an easy quip to say, hey, energy price suppression leads to, or any sort of price suppression leads to much higher prices. But in this case, you can sort of see the seeds of it as you have, equipment get cannibalized or, retired, as you have people sort of leave the industry. And then, you see these waves of malinvestment supporting the US economy, like the data center build outs and some of this other stuff. Hopefully it's great, but the reality is, I think you're better off having more wells drilled in the US than you are having more that incremental data center getting built in West Texas versus that incremental well getting drilled on a per dollar basis. I think you're better off as an economy with that extra well getting drilled. And so, failing to do that and failing to economically incentivize that by going and suppressing price through, weird geopolitical stuff and incentivizing production of foreign oil, I think is really going to backfire. And one of the ways it's going to backfire, I think, is much higher prices. Again, I just don't know if that's in 6 months or if that's in 3 years.
Speaking of that, let's and we'll end on this. I usually ask all my guests to walk me through the next 3 to 6 months, but with you, I want to ask, walk me through the next 1 to 5 years here on this, your expectations. Obviously, I'm assuming, but I don't want to speak for you, higher oil prices, but give me a spectrum, give me a range, not a range, a price range, but give me a spectrum of, what do you expect to happen? So.
So again, it's hard to tell exactly when, but I think you see some sort of supply disruption internationally, just to get back to sort of the average level of global supply disruption. And maybe it's just there's one extra hit on some Russian facility and you end up with 1 million barrels a day less from Russia for some amount of time, or whether it's Libya goes off again, or some other country I'm not thinking of offhand, or Iranian sanctions are actually enforced. And you have 1 million barrels that's come on at the very end of the Biden administration and the start of this Trump 2 administration come off. And so you have a little less sort of flex from this sort of illicit oil essentially that's coming on the market. And then you have US production start to come down. At current activity levels, you could see crude oil production in the US fall anywhere between 500,000 and 1 million barrels a day year over
Good
year.
gosh.
Yeah. I mean, it's really like you're really burning the furniture here. I mean, it's really tough. And then when you look at what's left for these various companies that had been growing or even to try to sustain their production, I mean, really, there's not. You look at like EOG in their core and the Permian. I mean, they had drilled some of the biggest and best wells. You look at Oxy, they're not replacing that inventory, not even close to it. And you look at the year-over-year production in their best areas, in their core areas, in these core fields, and the well productivity is falling. So you have lower prices and lower well productivity and lower rig activity. At some point, that actually does lead to much, much lower supplies. And then secondarily, on the natural gas liquid side, you've seen a lot of this activity as they drill longer laterals, as they more intensely stimulate the reservoir in order to try to, essentially the joke was when oil went negative, don't worry, the oil companies will make up for it by going with longer laterals, more frack stages, and more profit. And so somehow that would, make up for negative 37 or whatever when we saw that briefly during COVID. So I think there's sort of a similar idea that that's going to save things, and it's not. And not only is it not going to save the oil market, but you're ending up with all of this extra natural gas liquids production, anywhere from ethane on sort of the very light side all the way over to field condensate, which is another word for that's natural gasoline. It's basically very similar but not identical to what you get out of the pump. And so as we've seen this production, as we've seen this drilling activity start to fall, you're starting to see what had been very robust natural gas liquids production growth rates start to fall as well. And that's the stuff you need it for chemicals, you need it for your barbecue, for propane, you need it for an ethane. There's a lot of different chemicals plants. And so I think you're going to get into a much, much lower supply growth situation on the natural gas liquids as well. And I think that ends up sort of with a double hit, right, between crude and natural gas liquids coming down from, 500,000 to 1 million barrels a day of growth every year for the last decade to potentially, minus 500,000 to 1 million barrels a day every year. And so at some
Golly.
point, at some point that leads to much, much higher prices. And then it's not like you can just wave a magic wand and turn it back on the growth. A lot of the rigs that were being used have moved to other countries or, are in various states of disrepair. A lot of the pressure pumping horsepower that was being used has just not been maintained. And so a lot of that equipment gets cannibalized and just, repurposed. Some of the power that was being used for that stuff is now being used to power pipelines. And then also they're starting to take some of the stuff that was ordered for pressure pumping and use it to power data centers because there's such a shortage of gas turbines. So you're really, and then on the labor side too, when you see the labor force disperse, it typically takes 18 to 24 months to try to gather up the troops. And then even then it takes much higher wages to get people back into the oil field. So yeah, I think you're setting up for a shock, and it's weird to see the EIA data where they have this projection of oil production growth and NGL production growth that just you can't tie it to any real activity in the US. It's like a, you like are just learning Excel and you come out with this number and it's like, wow, look at that, it's great. Well, but it doesn't, it's a real number and you can't tie it. And I think there are some problems with the existing data where some of the folks that do this for a living, not for a living, like sell it to people that don't know any better, but do it for a living, like sell it to operators and use it for strategic planning and use it for, to better understand sort of field production dynamics and reservoir dynamics and so on. Yes, which I put out a where they're subsurface experts and they, help people with understanding their reservoirs and doing seismic, but also, trying to plan out depletion and so on. You look at their stuff, or like some of the pressure pumpers who have been pretty vocal on social media and elsewhere. I mean, the numbers that we're seeing that are in sort of these consensus expectations that you hear on TV with the various pundits and so on. I mean, it's just extremely difficult to it's extremely difficult to try to solve for or reconcile the EIA numbers and those sort of expert consultant or whatever numbers with the numbers that people are actually using for real production planning purposes. And so I'm going to go with the real production planning purposes numbers. And that means that it could get even worse from a supply perspective, because if we're at, let's say, 13 million barrels a day, not 13 and a half, and if we're on track to 12 and a half instead of the EIA's projected 14, well, that makes up for a lot of production growth from Brazil and a lot of illicit barrels from Iran. And then what happens the following year? And so again, as you roll all this stuff forward, people get really fixated. And again, like I've thought prices would be a lot higher and I've been wrong on that, but people get fixated on that and not the, okay, well, what drove that? And then what's going to happen next year? And then what's going to happen the year after? And we're just not seeing that negative second derivative, the negative now first derivative on production. I mean, man, it is wildly bullish. And that's not even considering some of the natural gas dynamics and some of the other dynamics that could really push prices higher, push demand forward, or sorry, pull demand forward. And it's a very, very misunderstood, sort of hated space. And then I'll just throw in one last one because I think it's really no one's talking about this. I've not seen a single person talk about this in sort of the from the oil analyst community or whatever. So we have gold prices at all-time highs, silver prices near all-time highs or at all-time highs, platinum roaring, palladium way higher, many other commodities that are very oil intensive at much higher prices. So when you look at the oil demand for that, both from sort of increased intensity of mining operations, which is one option for mining companies, where they sort of accelerate sort of existing resource development, as well as the likely oil demand from development of new mines, which you can see will be happening based on the like three equity raises a day that I see in my emails from these different, whether it's the junior miners just going and drilling a bunch more, whether it's some of the guys going into operations or some of the bigger guys going and raising money to build more mines. You're going to see hundreds of thousands of barrels a day of incremental oil demand, mostly diesel, but also gasoline, and then probably a bunch of chemicals and other stuff. And then you have a shot at, depending on what happens next, if gold and silver keep going up, or even gold flatlines at 4,300 or wherever we're at, and silver goes up a little more. I mean, the amount of oil demand that's going to come from these mines is truly going to shock the market, and you're still not. I think I started talking about this maybe a month or two ago, and I think I maybe saw one other person start to talk about it. I guess like someone woke them up or whatever. But this is probably the thing people are paying. The EIA numbers, I think people are sort of aware this doesn't make sense. There's some problem. No one's talking about this mining demand, and oil-related mining demand could actually be, if you have supply disappointments like we were talking about, and you have an extra, let's say, 500,000 barrels a day or million barrels a day of oil demand for mining, as there's essentially this new mining boom that's kicking off and ramping up. I mean, I think that's where you could see prices get really interesting. And again, if you're going to build a new gold mine, right, and gold is 4,300, I don't know what the forward curve looks like. Let's just say you could hedge it out for the next 10 years at 4,300. What do you care if you're buying your oil at net effectively $100 a barrel or $60 a barrel to supply? Yeah, it's a big input cost, but okay, so your average cost of supply might be 1,800 instead of 1,600, but if you can lock in 4,300 for your gold. And again, that's where I think people just are totally missing this next wave of demand. Yeah, there's this growth in China, probably still, and India and various other places, just from populations. But the industrial demand that's coming from mining in particular, I think is going to shock people. And we're already seeing it, right? We just every day I see these. I mean, I might have seen five because the gold price went up over the weekend, five today, but all these offerings, like that money, people are keeping some of it in commissions and salaries, but a lot of that's going into the ground, and the biggest single cost there, other than labor, is going to be essentially oil and oil product related expenditures.
On that note, I talk to CEOs literally every week, mining executives and CEOs, and a common thing, and they haven't said, I've heard nobody say what you just said, but they have said, hey, it's a great time, especially if they're producing, it's a great time to be in the gold and silver production because at $4,000 gold US and $50,000 silver US, and but the oil price is so low, we're making a huge amount of money. And in the back of my mind was just thinking, well, we'll see how long that lasts. So.
But again, every time you hear that, what you really like, again, this is one of those things, it's taken a while for me to try to be like more aware of noticing these things. What you're really hearing them say is, hey, if we have a notch and we can, or like a what do you call it, a control thing, and we can sort of dial it up or dial it down. Right now we're dialing it to the max because our margins are so good that if we have to go waste, 10 gallons of diesel to get 1 ounce more of gold,
We're doing it.
not only are we doing it, but like our shareholders are going to massively reward us for it. And so every one of those energy efficiency decisions that were made at $1,500 gold are being undone. And then, if there's some sort of controller on how fast your truck can go to whatever, they're breaking them. And like putting in like the turbo boosters for the trucks to have them go, 10 miles an hour up the hill instead of 2 miles an hour up the hill or whatever. And I know that sounds sort of funny, but I don't think people understand. I mean, I've been to some of these mine sites or talked to some of these companies. Very fortunately, a number of the different IR firms or whatever will bring companies to different cities. And I've gotten to meet with a number of mining companies over time, even though it's not my main focus. And there's been a large effort for energy efficiency and all this stuff. And right now, from what
That's
I
out
can
the
tell,
window.
is it's out the window. The message is produce as much as you can, as quickly as you can. And yeah, we still want to hear that you're a low cost miner, but like, show me more volume at $2,000 gold rather than, a little less volume at a 1600 or 1800 break even or whatever. So again, that's if you're the supplier of that thing that they're about to go waste in order to get a little more. And again, waste is sort of a strong word. It's economic, but they're going to go be much less efficient with it. And they are historically a large consumer of it, and it's one of the main inputs to their thing. I mean, it's a really, really fantastic setup, I think. And again, the mining executives, I don't think are going to tell you about how much oil they're going to produce, but they're going to tell you about how they're going to go expand their mines, how they're going to go, do more delineation. And then we are seeing some additional mines that are going to be coming on. And so, for a mine to come on, that's basically just picture giant yellow iron moving huge amounts of dirt, and then you're doing other fun oil intensive activities. And then that's the construction part. Then there's just the base activity level where I plugged this into AI. I figured, hey, I'll use a little more natural gas to get the calculation. And Grok thinks that in the next commodity bull market, which maybe we're in, for gold and silver and so on, that there'd be an extra 800,000 barrels a day of demand.
Gosh,
But that's
that's
steady state. That wasn't including construction. That was just for
right.
the if you increase the number of mines and then run those mines. But you don't get to, hit a button and you have another mine. You have to go use an enormous amount of oil in order to have another mine.
And then just do the math. Just think of the what we just talked about, the decline in production and then the ramp up in consumption with just adding more mines. Anyways, Josh, I'd love to have you on again. Next time, I'd love to talk to you about natural gas. We'll get to that one next one. I want to thank you so much for coming on. It was a lot of fun and just very enlightening. If people want to read your work, tell me about your Substack, your new Substack, and tell me about how people can find you and do business with you.
Sure. Yeah. So my day job is running an investment strategy for Bison Interests, and then where we've invested in oil and gas public companies for the last decade or so. And then for fun, sort of I went and launched this Substack, Bison Insights. So it's bisoninsights.info, and I've started to share some of the ideas that I've had of oil and gas stocks that I'm investing in, and sort of various other industry perspectives, and have had some friends and some very interesting industry experts on to chat about my very esoteric questions for them about trying to predict what the next thing is going to be, or what have you, or chase down that sort of incremental sort of industry indicator that may be the factor that drives either the next oil bull market or natural gas demand or inventory or so on. So yeah, that's how people bisoninsights.info is probably the best way to find me.
Got it. I will put all of this in the show notes on the YouTube channel, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Josh Young, thank you so much for coming on. I'd love to have you on again soon.
Thanks, Andy.
You bet.